Hairy faces. What a lot of hairy face men there are around nowadays. When a man grows hair all over his face, it's impossible to tell what he really looks like. Perhaps that's why he does it. He'd rather you didn't know. Then there's the problem of washing. When the very hairy ones wash their faces, it must be as big a job as when you or I wash the hair on our heads. So, what I want to know is this. How often do all these hairy-faced men wash their faces? Is it only once a week, like us, on Sunday nights? And do they shampoo it? Do they use a hairdryer? Do they rub hair tonic in to stop their faces from going bald? Do they go to a barber to have their hairy faces cut and trimmed? Or do they do it themselves in front of the bathroom mirror with nail scissors? I don't know. But next time you see a man with a hairy face, which will probably be as soon as you step out onto the street, maybe you'll look at him more closely and start wondering about some of these things. Mr. Twit. Mr. Twit was one of these very hairy-faced men. The whole of his face, except for his forehead, his eyes and his nose, was covered with thick hair. The stuff even sprouted in revolting tufts out of his nostrils and ear holes. Mr. Twit felt that his hairiness made him look terrifically wise and grand. But in truth, he was neither of these things. Mr. Twit was a twit. He was born a twit. And now, at the age of 60, he was a bigger twit than ever. The hair on Mr. Twit's face didn't grow smooth and matted, as it does on most hairy-faced men. It grew in spikes that stuck out straight like the bristles of a nail brush. And how often did Mr. Twit wash this bristly, nail-brushy face of his? The answer is never. Not even on Sundays. He hadn't washed it for years. Dirty beards. As you know, an ordinary and hairy face like yours or mine simply gets a bit smudgy if it's not washed often enough. And there's nothing so awful about that. But a hairy face is a very different matter. Things cling to hairs, especially food. Things like gravy go right in among the hairs and stay there. You and I can wipe our smooth faces with a flannel, and we quickly look more or less all right again. But the hairy man cannot do that. We can also, if we're careful, eat our meals without spreading food all over our faces. But not so the hairy man. Watch carefully next time you see a hairy man eating his lunch, and you'll notice that even if he opens his mouth very wide, it is impossible for him to get a spoonful of beef stew or ice cream and chocolate sauce into it without leaving some of it on the hairs. Mr. Twit didn't even bother to open his mouth wide when he ate. As a result, and because he never washed, there was always hundreds of bits of old breakfasts and lunches and suppers sticking to the hairs around his face. They weren't big bits, mind you, because he used to wipe those off with the back of his hand or on his sleeve while he was eating. But if you look closely, not that you'd ever want to, you would see tiny little specks of dried up scrambled eggs stuck to the hairs, and spinach and tomato ketchup, and fish fingers and minced chicken livers, and all the other disgusting things Mr. Twit liked to eat. Mrs. Twit. Mrs. Twit was no better than her husband. She did not, of course, have a hairy face. It was a pity she didn't, because that, at any rate, would have hidden some of her fearful ugliness. Take a look at her. Have you ever seen a woman with an uglier face than that? I doubt it. But the funny thing is that Mrs. Twit wasn't born ugly. She'd had quite a nice face when she was young. The ugliness had grown upon her year by year as she'd got older. Why would that happen? I'll tell you why. If a person has ugly thoughts, it begins to show on the face. And when that person has ugly thoughts every day, every week, every year, the face gets uglier and uglier until it gets so ugly you can hardly bear to look at it. A person who has good thoughts cannot ever be ugly, You can have a wonky nose and a crooked mouth and a double chin and stick-out teeth. But if you have good thoughts, they will shine out of your face like sunbeams, and you will always look lovely. Nothing shone out of Mrs. Twit's face. In her right hand, she carried a walking stick. She used to tell people that this was because she had warts growing on the sole of her left foot, and walking was painful. But the real reason she carried a stick was so that she could hit things with it, like dogs and cats and small children. And then there was the glass eye. Mrs. Twit had a glass eye that was always looking the other way. The glass eye. You can play a lot of tricks with a glass eye, because you can take it out and pop it back in again anytime you like. You can bet your life Mrs. Twit knew all the tricks. One morning, she took out her glass eye and dropped it into Mr. Twit's mug of beer when he wasn't looking. Mr. Twit sat there drinking the beer slowly. The froth made a white ring on the hairs around his mouth. He wiped the white froth onto his sleeve and wiped his sleeve on his trousers. "You're plotting something," Mrs. Twit said, keeping her back turned so he wouldn't see that she had taken out her glass eye. "Whenever you go all quiet like that, I know very well you're plotting something." Mrs. Twit was right. Mr. Twit was plotting away like mad. He was trying to think up a really nasty trick he could play on his wife that day. "You'd better be careful," Mrs. Twit said, "because when I see you starting to plot, I watch you like a wombat." "Oh, do shut up, you old hag," Mr. Twit said. He went on drinking his beer, and his evil mind kept working away on the latest horrid trick he was going to play on the old woman. Suddenly, as Mr. Twit tipped the last drop of beer down his throat, he caught sight of Mrs. Twit's awful glass eye staring up at him from the bottom of the mug. It made him jump. "I told you I was watching you," cackled Mrs. Twit. "I've got eyes everywhere, so you better be careful."
Saturday, November 7th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mother's nerves are very much on edge, and that doesn't bode well for me. Is it just a coincidence that Father and Mother never scold Margot and always blame me for everything? Last night, for example, Margot was reading a book with beautiful illustrations. She got up and she put the book aside for later. I wasn't doing anything, so I picked it up and began looking at the pictures. Margot came back and saw her book in my hands, knitted her brow and angrily demanded the book back. Well, I wanted to look through it some more. Margot got madder by the minute, and Mother butted in. Margot was reading that book. Give it back to her. Father came in and, without even knowing what was going on, saw that Margot was being wronged and lashed out at me. "I'd like to see what you'd do if Margot was looking at one of your books." I promptly gave in, put the book down, and according to them, left the room in a huff. I was neither huffy nor cross, but merely sad. It wasn't right of Father to pass judgment without knowing what the issue was. I would have given the book to Margot myself, and a lot sooner if Father and Mother hadn't intervened and rushed to take Margot's part, as if she was suffering some great injustice. Of course, Mother took Margot's side. They always take each other's sides. I'm so used to it that I've become completely indifferent to Mother's rebukes and Margot's moodiness. I love them, but only because they're Mother and Margot. I don't give a darn about them as people. As far as I'm concerned, they can go jump in a lake. It's different with Father. When I see him being partial to Margot, approving Margot's every action, praising her, hugging her, I feel a gnawing ache inside because I'm crazy about him. I model myself after Father, and there's no one in the world I love more. He doesn't realise that he treats Margot differently than he does me. Margot just happens to be the smartest, the kindest, the prettiest and the best. But I have a right to be taken seriously too. I've always been the clown and mischief maker of the family. I've always had to pay double for my sins. Once with scoldings, and then again with my own sense of despair. I'm no longer satisfied with the meaningless affection or the supposedly serious talks. I long for something from Father that he's incapable of giving. I'm not jealous of Margot. I never have been. I'm not envious of her brains or her beauty. It's just that I'd like to feel that Father really loves me. Not because I'm his child, but because I'm me, Anne. I cling to Father because my contempt of Mother is growing daily, and it's only through him that I'm able to retain the last ounce of family feeling I have left. He doesn't understand that I sometimes need to vent my feelings for Mother. He doesn't want to talk about it, and he avoids any discussion involving Mother's failings. And yet Mother, with all her shortcomings, is tougher for me to deal with. I don't know how I should act. I can't very well confront her with her carelessness, her sarcasm and her hard-heartedness. Yet I can't continue to take the blame for everything. I'm the opposite of Mother, so of course we clash. I don't mean to judge her. I don't have that right. I'm simply looking at her as a mother. She's not a mother to me. I have to mother myself. I've cut myself adrift from them. I'm charting my own course and we'll see where it leads me. I have no choice. Because I can picture what a mother and a wife should be and can't seem to find anything of the sort in the woman I'm supposed to call Mother. I tell myself time and again to overlook Mother's bad example. I only want to see her good points and to look inside myself for what's lacking in her.